This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. When a nation goes to war, the consequences reach far beyond the battlefield. Questions of duty, sacrifice, justice, and dissent move from theory into daily life. And today on Philosophical Currents, we're joined by Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota and Director of the Institute for Philosophy in Public Life. He also hosts Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, heard on the second Sunday of each month at 5 p.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public. He brings big philosophical questions into everyday conversation. Today, what war asks of a nation and what it asks of each of us. Jack, welcome back to Main Street.
I am happy to be here, although, as is often the case, the circumstances in which we are talking are very difficult. And I've been thinking about a related question to this over the last few days. It came up in one of my classes, which is this idea that this war in Iran started and all of these people are suffering. And yet now the things that are making headlines are gas prices. And that all of a sudden, the most real thing for many people is that their gas bill is going to be more.
And airport lines along.
Yes. And on the one hand, this feels like an ethical imbalance, right? 50 cents for a zillion lives. But on the other hand, we live our daily lives with needs and we all have to make it work. And so the things that impact us directly, concretely, that don't require our imagination can feel tremendously powerful. And really, that's just a thread that I've been pulling in my own head and directly connected to this question of what kind of sacrifices we should make, how we think of ourselves as a unified country, all of the things that you've prepared us to talk about. But there is always this tension, this fault line between the imagined empathy that we have of victims and the day-to-day impact that we face in our more mundane practical lives.
What does it mean, Jack, when we say as a nation that we're at war? And I understand exactly what you're saying. We are hearing all about gas prices and airport lines and other things. We're today not worried about really losing many Americans because we're so good at it, maybe. Is it different than it was maybe in World War II? What does this mean philosophically, beyond the military action itself, for us as a country?
You've asked two very different questions, although of course they're related. The first one is how we think about ourselves as a nation. And this is complicated, first of all, by the size of the United States, right? California and Texas and North Dakota and New York are all very, very different places and often feel like they're on the other side of the world. Additionally, different generations are going to experience this differently. If you are 80 and your kids are 50, you're less worried about a war than if your kid is 18 or you yourself are 18. And of course, certain industries and certain professions are very, very insulated from these issues. So the question of what it means to be an American, what it means to be part of a country, is always in tension with the other identity aspects of that we engage with. This is also complicated by the fact that in the United States, as I think you and I have talked about in the past, citizenship is a political distinction. It's not an ethnic distinction. In theory, a person who is naturalized is as much an American the moment they take the oath as someone who came over in the Mayflower. And so that leads to all sorts of complexities in terms of histories and ethnic loyalties and who you see as alike and who you see as different. And this is particularly complicated. This is made all the more difficult when we are at war in a region where we have a migratory population, right? Going back to World War II, putting Japanese Americans in internment camps wouldn't have even come up if we hadn't been at war with Japan. So the initial question of what it means to be an American is different than the question of how we feel the impact and why it was different than, let's say, in World War II. And one of the reasons why it was different in World War II is the draft, is conscription. That in World War I, in World War II, in Korea, in Vietnam, people were selected involuntarily to go to war, and everybody knew someone who was at the war. Everyone knew someone who was injured. Everyone knew someone who was afraid for someone else. Now, when that happens, that common fear overrides all of the things I was talking about in the other question. Once we have a shared sacrifice and a shared fear and a shared vulnerability, that becomes much more intimately connecting than all of these other ambiguities. So your neighbor may be different than you in some way, or feel foreign to you in some way. But if your child and their child are both on the battlefield, every day you're going to walk out of the house and see them in their driveway and say, have you heard anything? Did anything bad happen? Is your child going to come home for R&R? The moment you have that kind of shared vulnerability, you create a unified body that is much more powerful than all of the other abstract identity, all of the other abstract identities.
Jack, relative to war, as I was preparing for this, I read a little bit about just war theory, which is a framework, I think, in philosophy that asks the difficult question, when, if ever, is it morally justified to go to war, and how should war be conducted? So does that discussion, that theory, that framework still hold today, Jack, in modern conflicts?
We actually had a wonderful episode on just war theory probably about 10, 12 years ago with Michael Walzer, who's one of the most prominent just war theorists. And it is absolutely relevant. It's relevant in a variety of ways, right? Think about the way that our country reacted to Vietnam and this sense that there was a significant number of people, mostly younger, who were opposed to the war because they thought we had no business being there. They thought that we were getting involved in something that wasn't our problem and that we were victimizing people that shouldn't be victimized. So here are a couple questions, right? Can you be the aggressor? Is it always wrong to start a war? The general notion is if you are starting it, you are probably on the wrong, but there are exceptions. Second, are preemptive strikes ever moral? If you think someone is going to bomb you tomorrow, that's a very different circumstance than if you think someone is going to bomb you 6 months from now. But then once the war starts, there are a whole bunch of other questions. Like, for example, how do you deal with civilians? What's the difference between a combatant and a non-combatant? Is a doctor who is treating someone on the battlefield a combatant or a non-combatant? One of the problems with Vietnam was that it was a guerrilla war and the American soldiers couldn't tell who the enemy was and who the enemy wasn't. And so they would indiscriminately kill people even if they weren't sure of whether or not that person was a threat. And that's part of what people objected to. The history of war is super interesting in this respect because for a very long period of time, and think about the Revolutionary War in this instance, the generals decided in advance where the battle was going to be. They arranged a time, they arranged a place, they lined their armies up on either side of, let's say, a field, and then there would be an agreed upon signal and they would march closer and closer and closer and eventually shoot each other, which is why in school we learned this notion, don't shoot until you see the whites of their eyes. The musket was notoriously imprecise. And so if you fired a shot and it would take like 30 seconds to reload the gun, you were at a tremendous disadvantage. So the theory is, once you got close enough to see the whites of their eyes, you would have a much more accurate gun. But also, because the battles were prearranged, during the Revolutionary War, families would come and sit on the sidelines of the battle and have picnics and watch the battles. There is a real similarity here between sitting on the sidelines and watching the soldiers fight and watching on cable news the bombs over Tehran, except that when you're there and you hear the noise and you feel the wind and you see the blood and all this sort of stuff, it isn't as abstract. It doesn't feel like a video game. And so there's still this aspect of spectating with war, but it's much more distant. Again, going back to Vietnam, as has been documented a zillion times, one of the biggest impacts that led people to think that the war was immoral was the fact that it was the first televised war, that it showed the genuine costs, the genuine brutality, the horrible violence of war, and people reacted very, very badly to that, which is why images of our soldiers coming back from the front in body bags or in coffins and things like that are now very, very strongly controlled by the Pentagon, because imagery is really important. So all of this is to say that war has always been constructed based on the technology that we have. And this technology mediates how intimately we experience the war. And if we don't have someone who is affected directly, it is easy to compartmentalize the war and feel it more distanced and less important. This is why the last few initial wars were air wars, because the goal was you can show footage of super precise missiles bombing buildings. You can, the R team can feel like we're winning. We can bracket the death, and we can take pleasure in watching at the same time. Technology mediates how we experience war, and the more intimately we feel the war, the more strongly we're going to react to it.
I'm enjoying my philosophical currents discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's from the University of North Dakota, distinguished professor of philosophy. We're talking about what war asks of a nation and what it asks of each of us. Jack, what obligations do we as individuals have during wartime as citizens of the United States, especially those of us who aren't directly involved in combat?
I think it's really important that you added citizens of the United States to that question, because we are in a democracy. And so even if we didn't vote for the administration in power, they are in a certain sense representing us, and we have assented to their leadership in some really important ways. What that means is we are the authors of this war in a way that we would not be if we were, say, in North Korea or, frankly, fascist Italy or Nazi Germany, because the democratic structures that legitimize the government's actions are intrinsic to our identity as Americans and as citizens. So I think the first obligation we have is to ask whether or not this is a war we support, reject, and to let our representatives know our feelings about this. It's also really important to get a sense of the background, of understanding the context as much as we can, to make sure that our judgments about the war are well informed. And this is really hard. This is an aside, not that I don't always have asides, but this is an aside. But part of what a democracy does is create professional politicians so we don't have to know the details, right? We don't have to understand nuclear treaties. We don't have to understand military strategy. We don't have to understand the complexities of the global economy, we hire someone in essence to do that. And we try to hire someone who we trust, who shares our values. So the whole system is constructed for us not to have the kind of detailed information that we might need to understand why we're in Iran, why it might be good, why it might not be, why it might be bad. And so as an educator, I think it's really important for us to make the effort to really look at both sides of the equation. What's the argument for the war? What's the argument against the war? What would each side say about the other, to get a picture of the debate, to get a picture of the discourse, then to try to come up with an opinion and let our opinion know known. Now, with that said, I think we have the obligation to default to support of our troops and our government. And what I mean by that is not blindly support either of those. What I mean is we have to start with the presumption that what is happening is for a good reason, and all else being equal, try to be people who pay our taxes, maybe send gifts to people we know on the front, again, read the headlines. But once you start with that presumption, then as you become more critical, if you decide that the decision that the war was wrong or the actions are wrong, then your dissent becomes more powerful and more meaningful. It's more authentic. And here's what I mean by this. There are people who oppose this war because they don't like Donald Trump. I don't think that's a good reason to oppose the war. I don't think that our opinion of Donald Trump is more important than the empathy we have for the victims of this war, innocent Iranians, etc. I think that the question of the war is separate of our feelings about the president, and that goes the other way too. If we shouldn't just like the war because we like Donald Trump. The question of Trump is a separate question of the legitimacy of war. And what I think that means, and we've talked about this in various forms in other conversations, what I think this means is that we can't treat the people who are fighting in the war as symbols. We can't treat them as, I am willing to sacrifice these folks because of my loyalty towards the Republican Party, or I am aggressive and dislike these people for participating because of my loyalty to the Democratic Party or something like this. One of the things that our country really struggled with for decades was the way that we treated returning veterans from Vietnam. Many returning veterans experienced being yelled at, being spit at. They were called murderers, child murderers in particular. And there was this notion of held by many that just participating in the war made you evil. But it was a draft and it was a complicated situation. And it's just not that simple. And I think the legacy of that animosity has fed a lot of the conversations we've had now, right? The phrase, support our troops, bring them home, is a direct response to the idea of don't hate the soldier, hate the war. Don't blame or attack the pawn. Criticize the generals, criticize the decision makers. Yet, because nothing is simple, at that time, there was also another expression, which was, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And what if they fought a war and nobody came? There were a lot of people who, during the draft, during Vietnam, burnt their draft cards because they said they would rather go to prison then fight the war. And that's the complicated double-sided aspect of this debate, which is, on the one hand, we don't want to blame the soldiers because they're doing what they're told. The military is subject to a lot of complicated forces, and we have to listen to our commanders. On the other hand, we are free people. And if you consent to kill someone, you yourself have consented to kill someone. And there are people historically who have said, I will not kill another person, or I will not kill an innocent person, even if it means that I myself will die, even if it means that I myself will spend a life in prison. And so part of what we have to negotiate when we're talking about supporting or not supporting a war is what it means to support the people involved in the war who are on some level accountable, both because they're citizens, as we talked about, but also because they are free agents who can say no, even if the consequences of saying no are pretty serious.
We're going to continue our discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein in this Philosophical Currents discussion. We're going to talk with Jack about how we should consider those who do dissent and what we should think about governments and their control over the information that comes our way during wartime. Stay with us. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we are continuing our monthly Philosophical Currents discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota and Director of the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life. We're asking about war, what it asks of a nation, what it asks about each of us. And we spoke earlier about just war theory, what it means when our country is at war, and what obligations we as citizens of the United States have during wartime. Jack, we also mentioned those who dissent during times of war. We've seen that here in North Dakota for sure, and just this past weekend. How should we think about those who dissent? Is it unpatriotic or is it essential?
Dissenters are the heroes of democracy. People who say, what is happening right now is bad and I will vocalize disapproval, are the people we should celebrate the most, even if we disagree with them. So, for example, you're crossing a picket line because people are on strike. It is perfectly fine if you disapprove of the strike to cross the picket line. But to hate the people who are picketing is to misunderstand what it means to be a democracy. I'll give you sort of a silly analogy. People will come to my door all of the time to try to sell me something or to try to convert me to a religion or what have you. And I, like everyone else, get really annoyed by solicitors. But what I always do is I say, no, I'm not interested. And assuming that they are, you know, not horrible people and mean to me when I say that, I say, I'm sorry, I'm not interested, but do you need a glass of water? Do you need to use the bathroom? That act of recognizing their humanity can support their participation in the discussion without saying, I agree with or approve of or adopt your position. So people are out on the street in the No Kings protest or the anti-war protest. You should be happy and excited and enthusiastic about the fact that we have not just a society where that's possible, but also that there are people who are willing to make the effort. And that goes both sides, right? I mean, that could be if there's a march in favor of the war and you don't like the war, the same thing applies. Dissent is hard. Dissent against our parents, against our bosses, against our neighbors, that's very hard, especially in the upper Midwest, where we are encouraged to avoid conflict, to not call attention to ourselves. On the one hand, you know, there are 250,000 people marching in New York against the war, and there are 150 people in Grand Forks, and that's disappointing if you are against the war. On the other hand, what it takes to stand up in Grand Forks is a lot more effort and conviction and willingness to be vulnerable than it does in a place where that kind of talking back is culturally encouraged. So I think it's really, really important for us to understand that in most instances, and there are always exceptions, right? But in most instances, the people who are dissenting because they want our country to be better. They want our world to be better. And they're contributing. You may decide that what they think is a better world is a worse world, right? And you may decide that the methods that they are using are profoundly evil. That's your job to organize a counter-protest or make sure the letter responds or have a conversation if you know someone who's there. But to attack, belittle, diminish, threaten, try to imprison people who dissent, that's a violation of the fundamental agreement of what it means to be a citizen in a democracy.
We get to understand the war from a government's perspective. They control the information, if you will, during wartime. How does that shape public morality and consent when the information we get from a war comes from our government?
This is one of the hardest questions and one of the most relevant questions now because our information structures are changing so radically between AI and deep fakes and the nature of algorithms. It's distorted the discourse in some really important ways. And I'm going to say something which is going to sound like I contradicted myself. Earlier, I said, when a nation goes to war, the default position that you have should be to support the war, and then you develop an opinion, and then your dissent is more meaningful. I think when it comes to information, especially now, and especially from the government, your default position should be the opposite. I think you should read, engage, watch all information as if it's manipulated. You should start on the assumption that what you're seeing is not necessarily fake, but decontextualized in a way that supports an agenda.
That's scary to me, Jack.
It's very scary. But let me give you, again, this is an aside, but I think this is a really good illustration. So there's a certain group of people who will argue that in America during the slavery years, only 2% of Americans owned slaves. Now, this is true, but it's not really true. It's true in the sense that if you count every individual person, only 2% of Americans. However, that counts slaves as Americans. Right? So that raises the percentage. It also counts individuals as opposed to households. So that means that if there's a household that owns a slave and there's a husband and a wife and three kids, that's five people plus, let's say, three slaves. That's eight people. When you adjust for households who own slaves in slave-owning states, you get 30%, roughly 30% of Americans in slave-owning states owned slaves. That's a different message and different piece of information than 2%, even though they are both technically true. And that's what I mean by encountering information as decontextualized. Even if something is true, it doesn't mean that it's meaningfully true, or it doesn't mean that it tells us what we need to know in order to evaluate it. And so now, given all of the complexities and given the incredible information power of the American government, I think the default position is to ask, what is this trying to get me to believe? And therefore, what is it not telling me? Now, we can't do that in every instance. Going back to this thing of professional politicians, we're busy. We got to work. We got to mow the lawn. We got to feed our kids, right? We can't do that with every piece of information. So what we do is we develop relationships with different media, and we think, you know, Prairie Public Radio is largely trustworthy. So when they tell me something, I am going to largely believe them. Minnesota Public Radio, not to, you know, address our competitors, but Minnesota Public Radio is largely believable. And you and I have seen this because people don't listen to Main Street or Y Radio because of the topics. They don't look at the schedule and say, what is Main Street going to be talking about today? What is Y going to be talking about today? Maybe I'll tune in. They develop a relationship with Main Street and they say, oh, it's 3 o'clock. I'm going to listen to Main Street. What does Craig have to say? Oh, Jack's on. What does Jack have to say? And they develop a relationship because they trust us. They believe the things we say, or they hate us.
Let's hope that.
Completely, right?
That's true.
And completely distrusted. Like, well, Jack said this, so the opposite must be true, right? I mean, the patterns work both ways. So I think part of what dealing with information means in this instance is developing relationships with outlets that you can use as proxies for truth or falsity, and then start your inquiry as much as you can from that position. So again, we start a war. Maybe the initial default position is to support our country, to support our leaders, to support our truths, to support our wars. And that becomes subject to change almost immediately. The flip side is when we counter information, I think our default position should be this is misleading or false or designed to manipulate me in a certain way. And that can be changed almost immediately as well. And then over time, you have a political administration that you trust, and you have a political administration that you don't trust. You have there are certain political leaders that if they say something, my thought is, well, they lie about everything and don't care about what their constituents say. And so I'm not even going to pay attention to them. And there are other political leaders who I think, well, that person is smart and informed, and I'm going to take them seriously. And I have that same relationship with different media outlets. And I hope that everyone can cultivate that kind of relationship, knowing that at any time they or the media that they're relying on could be wrong or misleading. And that we don't always know what's going on behind the scenes. And so blindly believing anything always puts us at risk.
Had a friend, Jack, who worked for the Central Intelligence Agency, and part of his job was to read what Russian state media was putting out to understand that the opposite was likely true. And I wonder whether others read about American media, read American media or hear American media and wonder the same at times. It goes to my next question, I think, a little bit. There's a danger in war, I think, of just simplifying it into good versus evil. Do you agree with that?
I want to step back for just a second and make sure I answer that question. Make sure that the question got stuck in my synapses, because I think it's a really important one. One of the fundamental differences between a democracy and an authoritarian regime is that authoritarian regimes have departments of propaganda. And citizens know that what's released is propaganda. Democracies don't have departments of propaganda. Democracies do not use those terms and do not have offices of information that are designed to manipulate people in the same way. So we think that democracies don't have propaganda when they do. And so when you know, like in an authoritarian regime, that someone is lying, you are more resistant to the lie. But because we have a society and a government that pretends to be transparent, that pretends to give us information for democratic judgment, that makes the propaganda of the democracy actually more effective and more powerful. Jason Stanley, a scholar who wrote a book on propaganda and wrote a book on fascism, was also a guest on Why Radio, and he talks a lot about this, that the danger of propaganda in a democracy is that we don't know it's propaganda, whereas in other countries, we do know it's propaganda. Now, going back to your other question about good versus evil, I do not find convincing the perspective that God is on any one side, right? This notion of human wars are fought for truth or for, God favors this country as opposed to that country. I don't find that particularly persuasive at all. If there is a God, God doesn't work that way. And in my book on Israel and Palestine, which you and I have talked about, one of the things I argue is that that's really a conflict about land, and it's not about religion at all. So the very starting point that God favors one people and they are righteous invaders or righteous soldiers, that has been so profoundly misused and so profoundly just exploited that it means nothing, including the fact that even if tomorrow God talked directly to me, I still wouldn't know if that was God or if I was having a psychotic break, right? I can't know that the vision is real. So that, I want to reject that notion. Now, are there some wars that are about good versus evil? I think there probably are, right? The easiest example is World War II, but it's not the only one. There was an evil, genocidal coalition of countries that were trying to take over the world, and there was a more pluralistic, more open coalition of countries that were trying to stop them. Does that mean that everything that happened in Germany and Italy and Japan was evil? Of course not. Does that mean that all Germans or Italians or Japanese were evil? Of course not. Does that mean that America and Canada and England and even Russia were saviors of humanity and needed to be worshipped? Absolutely not. And part of the issue with World War II is, for example, it is often portrayed as the world fighting Germany to save the Jews from the Holocaust. And of course, that wasn't at all remotely true. That wasn't what the war was about. Does that mean that every American, every English person, every, I can't remember what countries, Russian is good? No, of course not. There's always this tension between the collective and the individual, and there's always this tension between the stated goals, what they say the war is about, and the actual goals, what the war is really about. And this brings us back to one of your early questions, which is about just wars, right? This is why the question of just wars is so important, because what a just war is a moral war that is fought for moral reasons. And that's the language of good and bad, and can be the language of good and evil. And we have our moralities and we have our theological and our religious beliefs, and we need to be committed to them and act on them when we think it's appropriate. There is evil in this world. There's tremendous, profound, unimaginable evil in this world. And a lot of that is right at our doorstep. And I will say this in a very particular way, because we're not talking about this. If what is reported about the Epstein files are true, that is an account of profound, inexcusable evil. evil needs to be stopped. But just because you're stopping evil doesn't mean you are inherently good. Sometimes evil fights evil. And sometimes you're fighting evil doesn't mean that you are fighting evil because it's evil. Sometimes you're fighting evil, you know, if there's a mass murderer in front of me in a baseball game and they're standing up and I have them removed from the stadium, they're not removed because they're a mass murderer. They're removed because they're standing in my way and I can't see the game, right? War is incredibly complicated, and any nation goes to war for 100 different reasons. We have to do our best to navigate that. And just because we believe something is evil doesn't make it evil. And just because we believe something is good doesn't make it good. But that doesn't mean there isn't evil and there isn't good. And that's the profound complexity of the human experience. We are all fallible. We all make mistakes. There is no such thing as 100% certainty. So I think the end result is you have to ask yourself, are you doing the best that you can? And if you're not doing the best that you can, ask yourself how you can do better. And if you are doing the best you can, say, I'm doing the best I can. That doesn't mean I have it right. And being aware of our fallibility, of our vulnerability, of the distortions that we face every day, that allows us to be more humble in the face of these tremendously complex decisions.
He's Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota. And this has been Philosophical Currents here on Main Street. It's where we step back to think a little deeper about the issues that are shaping our lives. Jack, we'll see you again next month. Thanks so much.
I certainly hope so. Thanks, Craig.